Hello, welcome to Zero to Agile Episode 5. I am your host, Phil Chipixee, and today's episode is the conclusion of Episode 4, the remaining questions from the challenges of adopting Agile Q&A panel that I sat on at the beginning of April. So I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you for listening.
We'll go ahead and move on to the next question that we had on deck here on the backlog, and it's really simple. It's simple to read, I should say, not simple to accomplish. So because you don't gather all of the requirements up front with the Agile approach, how do you size and estimate a project so you can set expectations with the business or a client? And I believe Steve wants to go ahead and start with that.
Yes, I do. Thanks very much for that question. That's a really excellent question. I love the terminology you used here, set expectations with the business or the client. What a great turn of phrase there, because it really is all about setting expectations. And I think the area that I always start with there is working with the, when do you expect this to be delivered? And general expectations about what exactly are you looking for? I know when I used to be more of a consultant, one of the first things I'll often work with people is, what is your budget? Because that gives me a sense of what their expectations are. If I'm looking at money, I will give you a dollar figure. If I'm looking at time, it's like, well, I need something by June. I need something. I've got $400,000 to spend. That's the starting conversation on what my expectations are. And once you have that number, then the neat thing about Agile is you can basically say, okay, based on that very large picture, we are going to give you this many releases. And you can often take your when you need it by, or how much money can you spend, how many people does that get you for how long. It's the, we are going to now give you this many releases, whether we're doing whether we're going to do an official release every iteration, or at least every iteration we are going to show you something, and we're going to do that. We're going to put those dates on the calendar. We're going to guarantee you that we are going to check back in with you at very regular intervals. And at each one of those intervals, we are going to show you exactly what we're working on, and we're going to be showing you working software. And that is really all around expectations. So you work with your client to get the very large picture to help understand what their expectations are, and often that's that end date or it's the budget that they have. And then you continuously throughout the length of the project keep coming back with them to keep showing the customer what you have been working on, and to make sure that those constant checkpoints help you align with the expectations. So what's really important with Agile is that if a customer is used to saying, here's a list of requirements that I'm going to give you, or here's something that I want, and you have to do all of these things by this date, you just have to shift that a little bit and say, well, that's really not the best way to have expectations around this software development piece. Let's instead, you tell us what your budget is, you tell us what date you need to do it, we will at a regular interval come back and show you what we're working on, and we will continuously work with meeting your expectations, and we will correct, we will change course if you need to, but the budget's not changing or the date's not changing. So it's that ability to constantly come back with the client to reinforce what they're getting, and to, at the outset, work with them to put their expectations around how big their budget is and or what date they need to be delivered on.
I'll jump in on this. So I completely agree with everything that you said, but I'm going to add an asterisk to that because it takes trust. And if you've got trust with the client, or if you're a consulting company or you're an internal IT shop or whatever, if you've got that trust, you can do that and you can work that. But the problem is we've created this history in the software industry of going over budget with a delayed schedule and still not meeting all the requirements. So you've got a lot of inherent distrust with companies. One thing that you have to do is come up with some sort of ballpark. And what I want to point out here is I'm actually going to kind of pick on the wording of what Ron put in there. It says, because you don't gather all of the requirements up front with the Agile approach. And that's true at a certain level. The thing that we always talk about with Agile is the last responsible moment, which is different than the last possible moment. The last possible moment is when my 10-year-old son does his homework, which is usually as the bus is pulling up. But the last responsible moment is, you know, for things like a project charter, when you haven't written out the line of code. Yeah, we're not saying do a big design up front. But there's nothing saying that you can't do some initial wireframes to talk about it, right, before you get the team together. And what I always do, or did when I was still consulting, is I would buy a copy of mock-up screens or Balsamiq, which are wireframing tools, and give them to my customer and say, look, you figure out what you want. You lay out the screens. It's very easy. It's an end-user tool. It's not a design tool. It doesn't come out looking pretty. It looks like it's drawn on a napkin. And they come back with wireframes, you know, that is if you have a UI or user interface, right? So with that knowledge, you have a starting point. You know, if you look at what they come back with and it's four screens, you know, you can say, you know, that'll take roughly 3 months. We're not promising that we'll get it all done in 3 months, but we think that we can get, you know, a significant thing delivered for you in 3 months. And then we'll follow Steve's advice, and we'll do the most high priority things, and we'll deliver everything we can, but we're going to fix the date, we're going to fix the budget, right? If they come back with 200 screens, then that's when you got to go, well, hold on a minute, right? Let's set expectations, because there's no way that we can come up with, as Joel talked about estimating, there's no way we have any idea how long this thing's going to take. We can either do it exactly how Steve suggested, which is we'll just do it in 2 or 4 week increments, and you tell us when we're done, or, you know, we'll go through a round of prioritization and get it down to a manageable chunk, right? It's like the old adage, how do you eat an elephant? Well, you eat an elephant one bite at a time. And at some point in time, you're going to get over full. Most of the elephant is still going to be sitting there. In other words, most of these requirements that you thought you needed will still be sitting there and determine you don't need them. But there's still some upfront work that you can do. And we're not doing the requirements at the level of, you know, what are all the data fields that are going to be on this screen, or what's everything that's going to be in a drop-down, or, you know, what are the database table names? No, but we can do wireframing, right, which is a great way to level set expectations with the customer.
I just wanted to, I used to work for a consulting company. I worked for 15 years at a company that had this pain. You know, I wrote a blog post on it years ago about the challenges of an RFP. So, you know, the whole question is, okay, Mr. Consultant, I need a house. How much is it going to cost? Well, tell me more about your house. Oh, what do you need? Well, you're supposed to be an expert. You tell me what I need. Well, no. Like, well, do you want it a two-story, a three-story? I need blue paint. Now how much? Okay, I'll need more than that. How about, you know, is there going to be a detached garage? Is it going to be, you know, a finished basement? Oh, you silly consultants. How about I need a tile floor and, you know, red doorknob, door handles? How much? Well, you know, the typical house costs about, you know, $500,000. And the customer goes, $500,000? Are you crazy? You guys are nuts. We get that a lot in software. We get these, you know, really crazy things that are asked of us, and we're expected to commit to it. And this happens in the consulting world a lot, much more than you might have seen in a product or even in an internal organization. We have to submit and create proposals to customers that are based on reflections of a television on the side of a building, and be expected to commit to it. And the reality is you know, I'm not afraid, and we were never afraid to invest as much up front to, as Phil pointed out, to do as many wireframes as we can. And to paint a set of expectations, yet a set of boundaries that understands that this is what we're estimating on. So if they didn't give us enough information, we'd have to fill in those blanks and then say, this is what we're estimating. And our estimates would always have a degree of variance based on the certainty of what we're doing. And we had very, very complicated ways of actually pulling out schedules and costs based on the size of the team and so forth that are based on that. And it was a very rigorous process, but it's just something that you needed to do in order to first get the work because if you don't bid, you don't get the work. And second of all, you have to protect yourself once you do get the work, because all of a sudden, once change does happen, and guaranteed it will, you need to have a reference point that says, this is different than what we quoted on. This is why we have mixtures of other methodologies with Agile, like PRINCE2, for example, that allows us to manage change a bit more explicitly, allow the customers to understand the impact of deciding upon change. You know, if you don't want the price to go up and the schedule to go up, then you have to sacrifice something else, Mr. Customer. And if they don't like that, then we have to expand the sides of the triangle. So it's a huge educational challenge with the customer. It's about setting and managing and guarding those expectations, especially if it's in a consulting type of an organization.
So let's move on to the next one. And it's quite simply, when you have a developer who can't handle freedom, not able to self-manage a sprint problem, what's the best way to deal with them? Micromanagement, or to try to change the person, or are there better suggestions? And I believe Phil wants to go ahead and start with this particular one.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and take this. So as we've all learned, trying to change someone else is usually not very effective. I can speak from experience. My wife has been trying to change me for 15 years. It's an unrealistic expectation to think you can change somebody dramatically. Again, I go back to the 10% rule. So again, I go back to there's academic Agile, and then there's real world, you know, I can implement Agile. And, you know, if you've got people who can't self-manage, you know, and it's an individual or something like that, you can do a couple of things. First and foremost is find a really, really good team, right? So if you've got a good team and you've got a couple stragglers, put that person with one of those good teams. You should never be, and this goes for yourself too, and certainly for me, it's one of the reasons why I got involved in speaking, is I never want to be the smartest person in the room. So if I'm with other people that are doing things more efficiently, better, you know, on time, that type of stuff, I will try and emulate that and try and be more like them. So you can certainly put them, you know, with a high-performing team. The downside of that is it can drag the team down, right, if they absolutely refuse to change. But, you know, chances are if they have respect in themselves and they want to become better and they just don't know how, that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to give them an official mentor. Have somebody work with them. The last thing I want to talk about to keep in mind is Agile never says it's going to fix all your problems, right? Nowhere in the Agile manifesto says if you do these principles and rules, then all your problems will go away. What Agile does is expose those problems, and it helps you to measure it. Anything that you can expose and measure, usually you can fix, right? So you got a developer who is struggling because they can't prioritize, or they're getting lost in the weeds, or they're constantly seeing purple squirrels, which I guess they just found the purple squirrel somewhere I saw in the news, so I have to come up with a different analogy. And just, you know, bounce them back and forth, context switching, things like that. Work with them, right? Have them, give them an example. Give them training. In the stand-up, it should become very obvious. If they come up and they say, yesterday I was working on the login screen, today I'm going to be working on the login screen, and nothing's holding me back. And then tomorrow, they say the exact same thing. And the day after tomorrow, they say the exact same thing. And then you go back and look at the story points or the estimate, however you do it, right? And it turns out that it's like a one-day story. And this developer's been working on it for a week, right? Well, now we've exposed it early. Right, there's a problem here. He or she's not admitting the problem because they say nothing's holding it back. So you can talk to him. So now we've exposed it. We've been able to measure it, and now talk to him. At the end of the day, you're going to run into two scenarios. A, they welcome the opportunity to improve. They're grateful to have a mentor. They're happy to be on a high-performing team so they can see how it's done, and they can learn and they can grow. The B is they don't care. They've done it that way for 25 years. You know, it's one of those developers who doesn't have 25 years of experience. They've got 1 year of experience that they've repeated 25 times, and they're not going to change. We can fix ignorance through training, antagonism becomes an HR issue. right? So at some point in time, if this developer is not going to change and not become part of the team, find a place in your company where they're very happy doing it, you know, the old waterfall way or whatever, but you're going to have to get them off the team, because if they refuse to change and they refuse to learn, they will bring down the rest of your team. And a high-performing team will become a lost team, and then everybody suffers. So hopefully that answers the question. Again, ignorance we can train. Antagonism, it's an HR issue.
So this is Joel. I just want to add to that. You know, my degree is in computer science, and I'd rather go and retake it in the study of human behavior, because that is you've really kind of nailed the head on the head. And you know, over the years, I've come across a number of things that has helped guide me. One is, you know, change people or change people. That might sound simpler to do, but that's your really only two options. You know, if you take a look at what you can change in people, there's skills, traits, and knowledge. Skills and knowledge, you can change. Traits is a very difficult thing to change. One of the things that you have to learn when you become a manager and a leader is understanding what motivates people. There's really only two types of motivations. It's either the avoidance of pain or pleasure of some sort. So usually human behavior falls into one of those two categories, that they're doing something for a reason. They don't want to get chastised or don't want to be exposed or for not knowing how to do a particular task or something like that. There's usually some underlying fear. And it's really all of our jobs to, first of all, identify that there are issues, and that's what Phil was saying, that Agile helps expose those issues. But if you can't essentially resolve some of those underlying things that help, that are encouraging people to behave poorly, then it's very difficult to, and I have seen teams completely brought down by a single person that had that characteristic. The entire team became dysfunctional and untrusting with one another, and it's a horrible thing to watch. You have a huge group of smart people, and one person makes them spiral down into oblivion. So how they interact is really, really key. It's a real tough thing. There's coaching and mentoring, but there is going to be a time where you have to change people or change people, and think about the health of your project and the value that you bring into the organization. You know, not all of us are human behavior experts and psychologists that can get to the root of the problem. But it's probably one of the toughest issues there is in any form of management, whether or not that's agile or, you know, and any other form of management.
So let's move on to a different question. What are the typical challenges you see in bringing in a dedicated test team into Agile?
Interesting question here. I have to admit, I'm a little curious what they mean exactly by dedicated testing team. And I'm going to take a crack at that based on some assumptions I have of what you mean by that, where you have a team of people who, I'm a tester. I just do testing. And I've got a group of people who you may have a testing organization that you may be working, or not testing organization, but testing division that is siloed off. And, you know, how do you deal with that? A couple of challenges you're going to find with that, there's often two ends of this equation. The first end of the equation is your developers. So now that I've got a dedicated testing team that is there, it's them and us, that your developers may suddenly feel as if they don't have to test anymore, is that I'm not responsible for quality. The testing team is responsible for quality. And that's just not all. And you need to work with your developers to make them realize that that quality is everybody's job. And it's not just the job of the testers to confirm that you write good code. It's your code. It's your job to worry that the code is good. So that's really important. And giving people that quality mindset, even if you have testers who aren't, in quotes, part of the team, it still doesn't mean that that developers can't do reviews of their code. They can't look over each other's code to make sure that the code is high quality before it gets, you know, to the testing team. So that's the one angle. The other angle is you may have testers who suddenly think that I don't need to be involved in any of the software development until the code is done and it gets handed to me for testing. And again, that's just not all. good testers, a good group of testing specialists will understand that they need to be in, the earlier that they involve, the better off. The better off they're going to be. So they need to be involved in design. They need to be involved in planning. They need to be involved all the way through. So just because it's a dedicated testing team doesn't mean that they're not part of the development process. So those are often the challenges that I see about bringing in those dedicated testing teams, is the mindset that the developers aren't responsible for testing anymore, and it's the mindset that the testers don't need to be involved until the development's done. And I think you need to tackle those head on by reminding everybody that we're all responsible for the quality of the software. And I often will hear from these sort of organizations where they'll find a bug in production and a developer will say, testing missed it. And my first response to that is always, hey, you wrote that bug. You wrote that bug. Yes, the testing team may have missed it, but you were just as responsible because you wrote it. And maybe it's not the developer. Maybe it was a BA who wrote the spec incorrectly. Actually, I just had that one in my review today where it's like, that's a bug. And it's like, well, that wasn't in the spec. And it's like, it's still a problem we need to fix. So whose fault it is isn't as important as we all need to take responsibility for this being done. And since I was kind of doing the BA work on that one, it was great for me to have other people share the responsibility. So that was good.
And just as an aside, so whenever a tester finds a problem, it's a bug, and whenever a developer is confronted with a bug, it's a change request, right? So, no, seriously, one of the things that you have to have when you have a dedicated test team, just as Steve said, is you have to have that team involved earlier in the cycle. Ping pong testing never works, and that's where we write a bunch of code, we throw it over the wall, the testers test it for 2 or 3 weeks or whatever the test cycle is, they throw it back over the wall, we do some coding, and then we ping pong back and forth. And in between these ping pong cycles, we're getting really good at Doom or Halo because we don't have anything to work on, because we can't continue working on features. So you need to bring the testers in early, but an important thing that has worked very well for me with really good QA people, and good QA people are hard to find. You might get mad as a developer because they find some things or they interpret things the way that you don't think they should be interpreted, but good QA people are really good. They really understand users. They really understand ambiguity and how to surface it. But the problem that really good QA people run into is when they are presented with, especially in the old waterfall style, you know, a 200-page requirements document or some huge product backlog. Let's say you are agile and you've got 400 things in a product backlog, and you're only working on 10 at a time, and you know you understand you're probably not going to do all of them, but you have to get your testers to understand that the only guaranteed deliverable is what's in your sprint backlog, or what's in your in-process column in your Kanban board, right? Everything else is a nice-to-have. We might get to it. We might not get to it, right? So if you can start there and get the testers to understand that these 10 things are the only things that we are promising that we will deliver, write your test scripts about that. It allows them to be extremely focused on writing their test plans. It allows them to not get stuck in analysis paralysis. And it also allows them to work in conjunction with the dev team. So if they're writing their test plan as you're writing the code, and you check in code and you declare it done, and hopefully you have a definition of done, right, for developers. And if you check something in and you say this feature or this task is done, QA can actually test in sprint, right, if they've got it done. Worst case scenario, they are trailing a sprint, but they're not waiting to the end because they've been trying to write test plans around 2,000 items in the backlog. They are testing as we go. And the best part about that is the best time to fix a bug is right after you wrote it. I write it, I check it in, the next day I get a bug that comes back and go, oh, I just wrote that. It's fresh in my mind. I can fix it. In ping pong, we write something, 6 months later, 3 months later, comes back with a bug. And you sit there and you look at it and you go, I have no idea what the heck I was thinking. Or worse yet, the developer that wrote that piece of the software doesn't work here anymore. Right? Now we have to figure out what they thought. So, you know, to expand on what Steve said, get them involved in the process early, but help them narrow their focus. Get them to understand the sprint backlog or that part of the Kanban board that you've only promised that you'd deliver. That's all they need to worry about, right? And then as you finish each sprint, they can add regression tests into it because they already have a full suite of tests of every feature within each sprint. And they only have to add a little bit to get the regression testing in. And you're going to have an extremely well-tested application by the time you get done.
Hey, did you know that Team Pulse is a simple and intuitive project management tool based on Agile best practices? By taking advantage of its unique best practices analyzer, your team can adopt Agile easily and painlessly, one step at a time. The analyzer automatically evaluates and then reports the project elements that do not conform to Agile best practices, allowing you to address problems early on and adjust. And now, back to the show.
So the next question is always an interesting one. One of the reasons why I've always liked this question when it comes up from time to time is the thought that you can't do Agile in these highly regulated environments. So the question is, how do you adopt Agile practices in a highly regulated environment? And I think we'll let Joel take a crack at that one first.
Sure. I mean, you know, highly regulated environments, they kind of emit this view of doing things in a very, very controlled way. You know, everything is done serially. There's lots of gates and entry and exit criteria, tons of documentation, reviews, sign-offs, governance, micromanagement, and pretty resilient to change. I think we can all kind of agree that that's what comes to mind when we think about regulations. But, you know, we have to think about why we have regulations. One of the things that they're not there to slow us down. They're there to protect. They're trying to make sure that people are demonstrating due diligence and best practices. I mean, that's why if you take a look at methodologies or sets of practices like CMMI, you know, those things were there because of the immense amount of risk and waste people were seeing, and it was a response to that. And it was just trying to make sure that people were demonstrating that there was some due diligence and that people were following quote-unquote best practices, you know, whatever that means. That their intent is to make sure that quality is increased, that there's reliable outcomes, and that there's accountability. Now, if we think about the reasons we regulate, number one, demonstrate due diligence, use of best practices, increase quality, reliable outcomes, show accountability. That smells a lot like what we can provide with Agile. Now, interestingly enough, a lot of people think that the range of methodologies is quite low when it comes to adopting or conforming to regulatory environments. You know, adopt something that's adverse to risk, that's scalable to the problem, that, you know, that is really solution-focused. Well, you know, Agile is kind of that as well. I mean, if we think about something that is going to expose waste, expose risk, get that out there as quickly as humanly possible so that we have an opportunity to adapt to those conditions, Agile is that perfect thing. What we're trying to do with Agile is reduce waste, to reduce risk, to increase the flow, to be higher quality, to be more predictable. These are all of our goals. Those goals match those goals that regulatory compliance want. So is Agile not an effective model for regulatory environments? I think that they are, that it actually fits quite well for the simple purpose that we know when things are going wrong sooner than later. We have much more focus on value and repeatability, and quality is completely built in. Now, one of the other things that sometimes we have to do with regulatory compliance, especially governmental regulatory compliance, is documentation. Well, you know what? In Agile, it doesn't say don't write documentation. Just you know, write the smallest amount that you have to do in order to produce value. What we're saying in regulatory compliant type projects is documentation has value. And it has need. All right, put it in the backlog. We'll get it done. I mean, it will displace writing code, of course, but, you know, it's something that has to do, has value to the consumer because the consumer is needing the documentation. It's a backlog item. There's just something that it doesn't have a should have or a could have status. It has a must have status. And when we think about how we organize and plan out our delivery, we're just going to have to take those regulatory compliant issues into perspective. Those are the must have features that we work around in our team and displace other things, of course. But those are the things that we're not going to that we can't move. Does anybody else have anything?
Yeah, I'm going to jump in. I'll be real quick. You know, again, I'm going to harp on last responsible moment, right? So the Agile Manifesto says working software over comprehensive documentation. And everybody says, ooh, Agilists don't like to write documentation. But if you look at the third paragraph of the Agile Manifesto, it says, while we value the items on the right, we value the items on the left more. Nowhere in there do they say, don't do documentation. If that's part of what is required to have working software, do the documentation. But do it at the last responsible moment. We all know that when we try and do all this comprehensive system architecture documentation up front, it's all wrong by the time we get done with the project anyway. If documentation is a requirement, then it should be part of every sprint that you are working on the documentation that applies to that sprint as a work item in that sprint. It should be a story. It should be a card. And that way you stay current. You meet all the regulatory requirements for documentation or for reviews or whatever those requirements are, and you can still be agile.
So let's go ahead and move on to the next question. We are coming out to about the last half hour. We have about 20 minutes left of questions to answer. So let's go ahead and move to a question that comes up a lot. Again, these questions that really hit home a lot with a lot of teams is, how can I have fixed cost, fixed duration projects and still be agile? And I believe Steve wants to start off with this one.
Yes, absolutely. So this question is interesting in that they talked about having fixed cost and fixed duration project. I love fixed cost, fixed duration projects where I have a team of people, that's usually my cost, and I've got so much time to deliver something, that's my duration, and I have to go and I have to go work on that. It keeps everybody really, really focused. You'll notice what the question doesn't include is fixed scope. If you have somebody who has fixed cost, fixed duration, and fixed scope, can you be agile? Not only are you going to have trouble being agile, you're going to have trouble being successful. So fixed cost, fixed duration, still be agile? Absolutely nothing wrong with that, and I think that is the best way to do agile projects, by fixing when you need to deliver and fixing your team size, fixing those resources, and then just driving with a goal very, very clear in mind. Obviously the question does become, well, I also want to have all these lists of features, and these all have to be done by this time with this team. Having a list of features may not necessarily be the same as fixed scope. And that's where you sometimes can get away with a little bit of wiggle room to allow you to still be agile, even when your customer may think that they're fixing scope. Lots of requirements, when they're looked at, you could build a requirement in a very simple way, or you could build a requirement in a very, very complex way. And I will often, when I've been given a set of requirements and I'm working with my team, I will often start with the very, very simple way and take that back to my customer and say, okay, we've done your requirement. And they look at it and go, well, that's not quite enough work. It's like, okay, well, we've done the simplest thing. We could continue on to go do work, but that's going to chew into your budget. Are you really sure you want to go on and do work on this one? Or would you like to go work on other stories that are maybe high value? And we can revisit this at the end to see whether you really do truly need those features, that additional enhancements to it, or this might just be good enough. And this way you might be able to get away with meeting the requirement, but still adjusting the scope as you decide what is truly, truly needed and what is potentially optional. So hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah, I'll jump in real quick. So interestingly enough, I wrote, I've got a couple blog posts out there that are very similar to these topics. And one is certainly scope, schedule, and resources. You can't have them all. And I welcome the listeners to read that. We'll post the link up there. But essentially, if you go to telerik.com/teampulse, click on blogs, click on Agile blog, And then you'll see several articles, not only by myself, but also by Steve and Joel. We all have stuff out there. It's not a product blog. It's all about Agile. And a lot of these questions, we go into much greater detail with pictures and arrows and a paragraph in the back of each one.
Let's go ahead and move on to the next question, and is how can I adjust my expectation of what we can deliver versus minimal marketable feature? So what do I expect to deliver versus what's the minimal I can get away with for release?
Yes, I can absolutely take this one. And it's funny, this does really tie in well with my earlier discussion about what is your must-haves, your real must-haves, as opposed to what can potentially wait. And the method that I use to adjust expectations, the one that I've been the most successful with, is to really focus on starting with the bare minimum that is useful. I read a really great article this week that talked about going Spartan, where your first set of features is really focused on telling the base story with the simplest piece that you can do, and then taking that back to your stakeholders and saying, okay, here's what we have. Is this good enough to ship? Is this enough for minimal marketable feature? Interesting, I just went through a review today with our product, Team Pulse, and we were talking about we were showing off some features that could potentially be in the next release. And my question to my stakeholders, including my executive vice president, was, is this good enough to ship? Is this part of MMF, or do we need to add more to this? Because if we are going to add more to this, it means you're not getting your release right now. It means you're going to have to wait. There is a trade-off. And I often, from my executive vice president, he talks about, well, I want both. Like, you're asking me to choose from which of my two children you want me to give up. And it's like, well, that is a discussion we're going to have, because I can give you this now, or I can give you more, but later. And again, it's really making it clear to people about that expectation that, you know, we're not necessarily done. We could certainly do more work here. And if you're unhappy with what you're currently seeing right now, we did the bare minimum. Like, we weren't padding or gold plating any of this. We did the bare minimum to get your feedback. And you now tell us, do you want to spend more on this? Or are you willing to ship with just what we have? Is this good enough for minimal marketable features? And I really often come back to that language. You know, it's, is this good enough? Is this good enough, or do you want to spend more on it? And that really does help handle those expectations.
So now let's go ahead, and we're going to answer the last question for the day. So I'm going to go ahead and read out the question. Is it better to start becoming Agile offline or online? And I believe Joel wanted to go ahead and take a crack at that.
So get asked this question a whole lot. And, you know, I've been an Agile coach and a software development coach for a number of years. And what I've found is that the most important thing that you need to do is start. So, you know, starting is really the biggest issue. I've seen organizations go, well, we can't start Agile yet because we haven't found a good tool. Well, then don't use a tool. use the whiteboard. You know, you use everything else at your disposal to be Agile. There's no requirement to use a tool to be Agile. However, on the other side of the fence, I have seen good tools guide Agile adoption, going, we don't quite know why we are entering story points in here, but this is what we're doing, and having a tool and the knowledge and the infrastructure around it to help guide the Agile adoption. What I'm a strong believer of, though, is that there has to be some investment before you even consider Agile or Agile adoption, that you should make the investment into learning what this thing is all about. So if that means taking a class on Scrum or reading a few really good books, there's a really great book that you might want to consider reading. It's called, I think, Adopting Agile, that helps kind of, it's actually a book called Succeeding with Agile, Software Development Using Scrum by Mike Cohen. It has a lot of adoption patterns that you could consider. You know, what should your first team look like? Should you really focus, should you absolutely be geolocated in the same office? One of the things that we try to promote as much as humanly possible is a highly interactive workspace where not only you can interact with your coworkers, but you have information at your fingertips. You can see, you know, your personas and who you're building your software for. You can see the rate of production that your team is moving on. If software is going to be an impediment for you to start doing these things, then don't use software. Go and invest in a $14 whiteboard and some sticky notes and go for it. And then once you learn more about the process, you might be better informed in helping find software that's going to help your needs. So my opinion is find the shortest method to get started and get started with it. I have seen that sometimes tools and tool selection, tool inventories, and tool features get in the way of starting. But I have also seen that once a team does get their feet wet with Agile, they're more informed in getting a tool that actually can conform to their needs.
And as the product owner of an Agile project management tool, I'm going to say that tooling is actually, there's a little bit of importance there. I will play that up a bit. Go figure. And here's some of the reasons why I would do that. Sometimes the really simple method, just whiteboards, doesn't work really well when you've got remote teams. It's not that it's totally unworkable, but often the tooling is needed when you have remote team members. And as much as I really, really hate not having people that aren't co-located, but having people in separate areas, it makes me very, very sad when that doesn't happen. It's becoming it's more and more of a reality these days. So tooling can certainly help when you do have those instances where you can't bring everybody in the same room to look at the whiteboard. The other advantage of tooling is that sometimes it's the hook to get people involved into the process. Like it or not, certain individuals are attracted by new shiny things. Developers are no exception to that rule. So I've worked with teams that if you come in and say, okay, everybody, we're gonna do a new process, they will tune off immediately, and they aren't going to be very, very happy about that, and you're just not going to be able to grab them. But you come in with a group of people and say, hey, we've got a new program that we're going to try and implement, and look at all the nice new features it does, look at all this neat stuff, and look at this new toy that we have. People might be more willing to engage. They have something to focus on. So you can use the tool as a little bit of the carrot to bring people to the process. So I don't think that there's necessarily anything wrong with putting the tooling a little bit more in front, try and bring people to that, as long as it's done with the end goal that we're trying to improve the process. I will really strongly echo Joel's comments on the importance of training, the importance of doing an investment in your Agile adoption that might be more than just tooling, but investing in the actual people. That's something that I really want to stress is important, to dump on people. It's like, hey, everybody, we're doing Agile now. Here's a book. Good luck. And then you leave. The chance of you being successful with that is fairly light. So bringing in a coach, sending people for training, those sort of pieces are really going to elevate your chance of being successful with Agile.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thank you for listening. If you have any comments, concerns, or suggestions, you can reach out to us at telerik.com/zerotoagile, follow us on Twitter at zerotoagile, or send us an email at zerotoagile@telerik.com. See you next time. Thank you.